Wabash Folklore Radio. Written by Andy Hertzfeld and Company, and read by Derek Warren. Black Wednesday by Andy Hertzfeld. Time frame, February 1981. I could tell there was something wrong from the moment I stepped into the building on the morning of Wednesday, February 25th, 1981. Instead of the normal office buzz, there was a muted sadness hanging in the air. People were standing around, huddled in small groups. I ran into Don Denman, who had a cubicle near mine, and asked him what was going on. "Didn't you hear? Scotty fired almost half of the Apple II engineering team this morning. He started calling people into his office around 9 a.m., one at a time, and telling them that they were being fired. I think over 30 people have been fired so far. No one knows why or who's going to be next. There's going to be a meeting out back around noon when he's supposed to tell us what's going on." Apple had just gone public a couple of months ago, and it was still growing at a frenzied pace. Sales were booming, and there was no financial reason to pare back. I wondered what was happening. "Do you know who they fired?" I asked Don. "Yeah, it's amazing. Scotty fired 3 out of the 4 managers, so almost everyone's boss is gone. And believe it or not, they fired Rick Ariccio." I thought that the managers were more or less incompetent, so that didn't bother me. But the Rick Ariccio part was shocking. Rick was clearly one of the most talented programmers in the Apple II division and would usually do a week's worth of work in a day or two, spending the rest of the week messing around with whatever caught his fancy, usually one of the latest games. I understood how he could be a management challenge, but it made no sense to fire him. He was my partner on the Apple II DOS 4 project, which was just getting underway, and he was the only other programmer besides me that was working on it, so it was especially distressing that they would fire him so abruptly. I joined the ranks of the shell-shocked and listened numbly to the outdoor meeting where Scotty explained his rationale. He said that the company had grown much too fast over the last year and had made a few key bad hires, who themselves had made even worse hires. He thought the Apple II division had become too complacent and that Apple had lost the startup company hustle that was the basis of its success. He wanted to shake us out of our complacency and prune the bad hires so we could start growing in the right direction once more. Scotty himself seemed a bit shaken and unsure. Some of the other senior executives were standing off to the side, but they didn't participate in the meeting. Steve Wozniak was there and didn't look too happy about things. There was a question and answer session at the end of the meeting, where a couple of employees told Scotty how horribly he handled the situation. But in general, everyone seemed listless, as if they didn't know how they should react. Within a few days, everyone was referring to the incident as Black Wednesday. Later that afternoon, I talked to Dick Huston about what had happened. Dick was an early Apple programmer who had written the boot ROM for the Apple II disk controller card. He was an astute observer of Apple politics, as well as being friendly with Scotty. He told me that he knew that the purge was going to happen and had even met with Scotty a few times over the last week to help him generate the list of dead weight. He also told me that Scotty had asked for the approval of Mike Markkula and the board of directors and hadn't received it yet, but decided to go ahead and do it anyway. I told Dick that I agreed that Apple had made some poor hires over the last year, especially some of the managers, but a Stalin-like purge was not a valid way to run a company. I complained about Rick's firing and told him that the situation made me feel alienated from the company. I was the type of programmer who had to believe in what I was doing, and I was now uncertain about Apple's values. When I arrived the next morning, there was a message on my desk from Mike Scott's secretary saying that he wanted to talk to me. I called her back and arranged a meeting with Mike. Obviously, Dick must have talked with him. Scotty looked harried, and our conversation was interrupted by several phone calls. Scotty said he heard that I was upset and was thinking about leaving, and wanted me to know that he wanted me to stay. He asked what he could do to get me excited about Apple again. I responded that I might like to work with Burl and Bud on the Macintosh project. Later that afternoon, Scotty's secretary arranged for me to talk with Steve Jobs. By this time, Steve had been involved with the Macintosh project for more than a month, and although I didn't know it at the time, he had dismissed Jeff Raskin, the founder of the project, the day before. Jeff was now on a mandatory leave of absence after having complained about Steve's leadership. Lots of people at Apple were afraid of Steve Jobs because of his spontaneous temper tantrums and his proclivity to tell everyone exactly what he thought, which often wasn't very favorable. But in the few interactions that I had with him, he was always nice to me, although sometimes a bit dismissive. I was excited to be talking with him about working on the Mac. The first thing he said to me when I walked into his office was, "Are you any good? We only want really good people working on the Mac, and I'm not sure you're good enough." I told him that yes, I thought that I was pretty good, and that I was friends with Burl, and had already helped him out with the software a few times. "I hear that you're creative," Steve continued. "Are you really creative?" I told him that I wasn't the best judge of that, but that I'd love to work on the Mac, and thought that I'd do a great job. He said that he'd get back to me soon about it. A couple of hours later, around 4:30 p.m., I was back to work on DOS 4. I was working on low-level code for the system, interrupt handlers and dispatchers, when all of a sudden I noticed Steve Jobs peering over the wall of my cubicle. "I've got good news for you," he told me. "You're working on the Mac team now. Come with me and I'll take you over to your new desk." "Hey, that's great," I responded. "I just need a day or two to finish up what I'm doing here and I can start on the Mac on Monday." "What are you working on? What's more important than working on the Macintosh?" Steve asked. "Well, I've just started a new OS for the Apple II, DOS 4.0, and I want to get things in good enough shape so someone else can take it over." "No, you're just wasting your time with that. Who cares about the Apple II? The Apple II will be dead in a few years. Your OS will be obsolete before it's even finished. The Macintosh is the future of Apple, and you're going to start on it now." With that, he walked over to my desk, found the power cord attached to my Apple II, and gave it a sharp tug, pulling it out of the socket and causing my machine to lose power and the code I was working on. He unplugged my monitor and put it on top of the computer, and then picked both of them up and started walking away. "Come with me. I'm going to take you to your new desk." We walked outside to Steve's silver Mercedes, and he dropped my computer into the trunk. We drove a few blocks to the corner of Stevens Creek and Saratoga Sunnyvale, to a nondescript, brown-shingled, two-story office building next to a Texaco station, while Steve waxed eloquent about how great the Macintosh was going to be. We walked up to the second floor and into a room behind an unlocked door. Steve plopped my system down on a desk in an office near the back of the building and said, "Here's your new desk. Welcome to the Mac team," before darting off. I started looking around the office and saw Burl Smith and Brian Howard in the next room, huddled over a logic analyzer connected to a prototype board. I told them what happened, and they said that Steve had been over earlier, asking them if they thought I was any good. They were happy that I had officially joined the team. After helping them with the disk diagnostic routines they were trying to debug, I returned to my new desk and looked inside the drawers. I was surprised to see that it was still full of someone else's stuff. In fact, the bottom drawer had all kinds of unusual things, including various kinds of model airplanes and some photography equipment. I later found out that Steve had assigned me to Jeff Raskin's old desk, which he hadn't even emptied yet.